Vagabonds, Life on the Streets of 19th Century London. Compelling, moving, and unexpected portraits of London's poor from a rising star British historian. Dickensian city brought to real in vivid life. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from somewhere west of Newcastle. Rising star British historian, Oscar Cole. Oscar, good morning to you. Oscar Cole Jensen, sorry. Get your name right.
Thanks, Charles. It's nice to be considered rising at still a fairly early time on an English morning anyway.
Exactly. Now, just to warn you in advance, and I always say this whenever we have something like this, I'm that worst sort of creature. I'm an armchair historian, so watch it. So here we go, okay?
That's fine. I do most of my writing in an armchair anyway, so I have some sympathy.
Super. So tell me a little bit about that, because it is... Dickensian London and Victorian life is a very interesting period to study, because we have these huge contrasts, and the Victorians were masters, if you like, of what we call fake news, the spin, the empire, you know, the huge developments in education, etc. But there is this dark side to the whole situation, isn't there?
You've really pinned something down straight away that's sort of at the heart of the book there. Yeah, okay, kudos to your armchair historianing. Not just Victorian, by the way. This one starts in about the 1780s and goes till about the 1870s, but publishers do like to put a nice name. Like Victorian, that's the word we really...
Mary Poppins, etc. They're thinking grinning chimney sweeps and little matchstick girls, aren't they, basically?
I've got a matchstick woman in this, and chimney sweeps do appear dancing on their feast day. But yeah, that Victorian idea we have may be slightly prejudiced, slightly bigoted. Empire, you say, this whole construction of a space of workhouses, poorhouses, Oliver Twist there in your mind. That world is very much real, and it is oppressing people on the street. But the thing I found in this book was the extent to which life on the streets of a city like London, an amazingly international, global, cosmopolitan city in the 19th century, a city that is desperate to be entertained, tells a completely different story, a story where people are welcomed, embraced with open arms, and where any number of quite exciting, subversive, left-field things can go on that really blow your minds from your perception of the Victorians as this quite uptight, conservative set of people.
One of the things as well was the fact that life on the street, we're looking at the street here as, it's not something, and this is going to sound really, really bizarre, it's not something to get A to B with, but the street is actually a social channel. So when you talk about bustling streets, we're not talking about the number of people like going down Oxford Street today and trying to get a clear path through, but we're talking about the street as a destination, because upon the streets of life, all human life can be found, etc. And you interact on the street in a way that you don't do head down with your face on an iPad or whatever.
Well, you really have been paying attention. Well, the problem here is that you have exactly both of those things at the same time. And the modern Victorian way is precisely A to B. What are streets for? They're to get somewhere. They're to get money somewhere. You have taxi cabs coming in. You have the hansoms. You have these very earnest walkers desperate to get to their office or something. And to them, people living in the street are a problem. But for centuries before that, and still in many places around the world today, the street, as you say, is a destination. It's where people go to get their food, especially when you can't cook at home, either because you don't have a home or because very few people have a working kitchen in this period. Food and drink, news, entertainment above all. It's a place to live. It's where all these things carry on. But increasingly in the 19th century, people are starting to think that's not how things should be done. And if there's a crowd here, you know, doing business, being entertained, carrying on with their day, that crowd is suddenly a problem. And that's why you get all these confrontations.
The one of the interesting things is, because you're doing this from the Georgian period into the Victorian period, again, how do you research something like this? Because presumably it is mainly an oral tradition here when you're talking about street vendors or street entertainers or street markets, because I would imagine the standard of literacy, although it's better than, say, in medieval England, for example, or London Bridge, etc., an awful lot could either be written dismissively or conversely romanticized. Again, we're going back to our street urchins, lovable rogues, etc.
Yeah, that's exactly why I've written this book. I think I was led by voices, and first-hand voices above all, because so many accounts of the streets of London do come from above. You mentioned Dickens right at the start there, those sort of top-down romanticizing or condemnatory visions of life on the street. But the period roughly at the end of the Napoleonic Wars, so after a lot of British working-class men have been in Spain in particular and come back and suddenly felt they have a story to tell that is worth the telling. This is really crucial. You have soldiers who feel they've been part of a major war effort. They have their life is worth other people reading about. At the same time, you have a load of people getting religion, Methodism, and so on, who also feel their conversion experiences are worth talking about. And so you have this whole mass of the populace who before have been quite deferential, illiterate, suddenly learning to read, learning to write, but also feeling their voice deserves to be heard. So you start getting a lot of memoirs, a lot of first-hand accounts. Those are almost all by men, which is a problem. So I've really struggled in this book and gone out of my way wherever possible to hear women's experiences where we can. And that's where the other first-hand accounts come in. And it is oral in a sense because it's court testimony. Mm. So many of the people I've come across, they're not willingly giving us their voices. They're doing it under duress. And those testimonies, yeah. Of course, yeah. And they're written down by a scribe. Sometimes they're published. So it's not necessarily always word for word, but we are getting what people are saying out loud about their lives written down, normally because they're on trial for something.
And talking about that, I mean, I know we're doing a show and it's currently 21 minutes to 11 on a Friday morning, but presumably the female experience working on the street, I mean, we can either talk working on the streets literally or selling produce on the street. I mean, it's open to what we now would term abuse, isn't it, basically?
I feel really sorry for, in particular, there's a milkmaid called Cato Cagney. She's called by Arthur Munby, the queen of the milkmaids. So, you know, she does incredibly long hours. She works like 18-hour days. She hasn't had a holiday in 7 years. You're carrying two pails of milk constantly for miles around London, doing this incredibly hard and incredibly important job to keep London going. But if she stops in the street and talks to a man, her reputation is in massive danger because so many people, their only perspective of what a woman is doing on the street has to be through prostitution in this era. There's such a fear and terror that this is all that's happening. And it's incredibly reductive, but it's something women have to deal with every day. So when you do look for, I suppose we could say sex workers at this time in the morning on the street.
Yeah, we can say sex workers this time in the morning, yes.
They're also fascinating, yeah. And the extent to which they are actually accepted members of their community, they often marry. The thing that Victorians in authority really hate is that these people don't necessarily all get ill and die, but prosper yeah. and marry. And yeah, Sarah Tanner, she's a very successful prostitute. She opens a chop house by Blackfriars Bridge. She invites someone who knew her in her working days to come along. I'll grill you a chop.
That goes back to what I was saying before, this sort of underbelly, because there is massive hypocrisy in the Victorian age, as there is still today. But it's the whole situation with we are strict moral and we're tight buttoned, the whole thing, and yet just flip it, just walk down a side street in Victorian London, and well, you can get yourself into all sorts of trouble, to put it mildly. If take me by the hand and lead me gently through the streets of London, But what would we find? One of the things I said, it would be a visceral assault on the senses, wouldn't it? Because you'd have the sights, the smells, and the sounds of London street life.
Yeah, and it does depend when, because I take you through the hand in the 1850s, say, and as you might expect, it might be a bit foggy, a bit muggy, a bit stinky. The Industrial Revolution is in full swing, and visitors to London from other cities. So we have people living on the street. So this girl who becomes an amazingly famous actress, Adelaide Neilson, but starts off sleeping rough in Hyde Park. She'd come down from Geesley near Leeds, and she is just overwhelmed. She walks for miles, just these buildings around her, just oppressive, like walking in a canyon. She eventually finds Hyde Park. She's just so excited to see some trees and some open sky that she thinks, I'm going to bed down here for security. So there's that overwhelm of the unnatural, almost not the sights and sounds and smells, but simply the lack of organic life really gets to some people. But at the same time, say you're going to the theatre in Islington in about 1810, and you're coming from central London, you might bump over a cow. Say you're in St. Giles in Covent Garden and you want to get to St. Pancras, the straightest way is over some fields. So we're at this point where London is expanding massively rapidly, but you still have the country in the city. You might go to Regent Street, want some milk. There's a dairy there. you know?
A dairy in Regent Street. A dairy in Regent Street, okay.
Yeah. Smithfield Market, the cattle are amazing. The extent to which you might be gored by a bull if something goes wrong is also, I think, really, really interesting. The sights and sounds and the smells, the tastes is the other thing I throw in. Definitely the tastes. The most interesting people on taste are young boys. So all of these memoir writers I was talking about, normally they're writing a bit later, but the most vivid period of their lives are in their, say, aged about 9 to about 14. That period where life is very real. And so many of these boys on the street, they are hungry above all. And dossing down for the night, but mostly trying to get food. And you see them catching food in markets, and the way they talk about peas pudding, Thomas Holcroft, he gets some rich peas pudding, he's instantly sick. It's just the richest thing he's ever eaten. There's another boy, Frank Bullen, who manages to steal some whelks from Billingsgate Fish Market. And he's very excited about these things. And then he realizes, however much he tries to break them down, he can't eat them because they haven't been boiled yet. And he's just got these completely inedible things, and he is devastated. Young boy called Billy Tagg, he's really excited to get a couple of onions because you can make a fantastic stew with a couple of onions and a rabbit's ear or something. They're really keen.
How was the tomato market in London? Has it changed? Because obviously now tomatoes are probably worth more on the street than sort of 3 kilos of Finest Colombian Flake. So therefore, I mean, you talk about things like whelks and peas pudding. Because again, that's, and I mean, we're not talking about a culinary history of London here, but it's interesting that those sort of dishes have all but evaporated or have been reimagined by Hoxton chefs in a very strange sort of modernist way.
Yeah.
But again, you get that what was available, what was eaten, because you know you can link street. We talk about street food, which sounds very, very trendy now, but that's a whole thing about nutrition and society, and you know, we talk about zero produce, but obviously things like whelks and things like making soups out of a rabbit's ear, these were options that were available to people living on the street, and also the sort of produce that was sold on the street as well, because they certainly weren't dishing out sushi in the 18th century, were they?
Well, the biggest change is oysters. Oysters now are sort of absolute luxury food. You know, you might, certainly in the UK these days, I don't know how the case is in Spain, but oysters are the food of the poor in this period. And the oyster girl, she'll, you know, oysters raw on the street is exactly just about the cheapest thing you can get, which is a remarkable change. Yeah. Not so many tomatoes that I've come across. A lot of Seville oranges, I tell you that. The orange is sort of this totemic thing. And I suppose it keeps well, and it comes in its own wrapping, and it gives you a burst and flavour of something as different from the grey world around you as you can imagine.
And I suppose as well, the whole thing, that whole citrus thing as well, because they kind of discovered the vitamin C would keep off scurvy, especially because of the British Empire. We had a navy that ruled the world.
At the start of this period.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. What about?
I do worry about the nutrition of these people. The one thing I have to mention is bread, because the fluctuating bread price, in as we're talking in a time of cost of living crisis and huge supply chain issues and fluctuations in the prices of things like bread, it determines everything, the price of bread. And that's pegged to markets and harvests, especially bad harvests and the worrying about hoarding. But a loaf of bread, which will be your sort of staple food for a week, that's more of a cost to you than accommodation. And that's another thing to get your head around. We're not talking about so many people sleeping rough because you can doss down for a night for a penny, for a halfpenny sometimes, because people might sleep 10 or 12 to a room. People are sharing beds, all that sort of thing. You can get a roof for the night easily. Getting enough bread to eat is the hardest thing to try people on.
And that's, you could do an entire narrative, couldn't you, on the fluctuating price of bread and the welfare of the people. And bread is something that comes, you know, from early 16th century all the three way to the 30s, because in the States, one of the great things about the Depression is give us bread and give us roses. That was one of the American Communist Party, the American Socialist Party's sayings.
You're coming onto another subject, dear to my heart, protest song. Yeah, the song Bread and Roses is very much there. In France in 1792, the biggest chant you'll hear on the streets of Paris, as opposed to London, is Bread and the Constitution of 1792.
Yeah.
That's what people want.
Yeah. Exactly.
But forget butter. Comes first.
It scans better too, but you think they would have put it actually on the other way around, because I'm sure there's more stuff that rhymes with bread than the Constitution of 1782?
1792. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
I'm sure listeners can contribute many.
I'm talking about street criers here. Is that people just, is it providing news? Are we going back to the oh yay type of thing? Or is it just basically people saying, I've got this for sale, have a look at this?
It's everything. And this book was originally going to be called When London Cried, both because there are a lot of tragic stories in here and because it is a time when everywhere people are crying out in various ways. Then my publishers thought that might be a bit of a downer, which is why we went with Vagabonds. But crying on the street, putting your voice literally out there, is the hallmark of this era. And the street cries of London, people always, you know, listener, you might have one or two of those in your head. Buy my lovely fresh lavender, that sort of thing. Or oysters, new oysters. And they get quite complex, some of them. Some go on for quite a long time. It's hard to tell which are real, which have been converted into song. Cherry ripe, ripe, I cry by a broom. Those sorts of things. They're everywhere. They're all around and people love them. So those are just to sell food and produce. But I mean, my own special favorite thing is songs on the street, because, and that's not so much about news. You get news vendors, you get people with little horns. They blow a horn and they sell you a newspaper. Or you might get that street crier in the rural outskirts of London who sort of, this is the latest news. But the songs are everything. They're mostly entertainment. They're and tales of love and loss.
And thank you for that brilliant burst of sort of Gilbert instead of operetta. But is the, you know, how have they carried down? Because unless they were putting them on wax, literally, how on earth have those songs or those couplets or those bursts of verse survived? Or was there a budding anthropological sort of composer noting down in longhand the sharps and the flats and the clefs?
Yeah, he's called William Gardiner. He writes his big treatise in 1832.
Brilliant.
Yeah. You can go to the British Library Sound Archive online, bl.uk, and have a little search about, because in the late 19th century, there are wax cylinder recordings of some of this stuff. There are some lavender cellars, for example. But people are notating this down for centuries. It's part of a composing tradition since Tudor times, actually. You get people like Orlando Gibbons, who are writing polyphonic cries of London. Those, as a historian, one would be more skeptical of, because they're taking sort of the lowest musical form they can think of and making high art music out of it. So it's this elaborate joke, if you like. But from, say, the late 18th century, when, yeah, people like Bishop Percy are starting to note down songs and get into this idea of antiquarian song, people are starting to do that with street cries as well, because there's this constant sense they're disappearing. So people like William Gardiner, they are going out around the back streets and they're notating them and they're putting them down.
Absolutely brilliant. I love it. What street crime? Because we're back to our lovable urchins, aren't we? And Fagin's gang and the whole thing. How dangerous was life on the streets in terms of? I'm not talking about being, you know, holed often by a footpad and, you know, sort of missing a kidney. But was there presumably petty crime, pickpocketing, etc.? You weren't allowed to get sort of. I'm not talking about gangs. We're not as a teenage friend of mine said, London's got a bit stabby recently, which I thought was a brilliant quote. But what was your chance of getting pilfered, shall we say?
Well, it depends how gauche you are and what you've got on you. And there are endless publications, if you're coming to London, warning you about these dangers. And again, it's a case of knowing how much to just lean into and believe these things and how much they're sensation fiction. I've come across mostly pickpockets, actually. Young boys are obvious pickpockets if you fall in with the wrong crowd, and their techniques are amazing. I'm going down to the detail of growing your index fingernail really long and then cutting it to a point so you can snag a purse on your fingernail, which is a lovely little detail. And actually really important, because the most dangerous thing if you are a pickpocket is to carry a pair of scissors on you. James Hardy Vaux, who he's born quite wealthy, and then he descends to a life of crime through gambling and debt. He gets transported to Australia not once but twice.
That good going,
being had up. Yeah, and these are both for pickpocketing. And one of them he's really annoyed, because one of them he's technically innocent despite the fact he's committed hundreds of crimes by this point. But the thing that really gets him is when he's taken away into custody and they find a pair of scissors in his pocket. That's damning. So if you've got a silk handkerchief, if you've got a purse, keep it very close to you and know what's going on, because that's the way they get you. And it's one of the reasons people are very scared of crowds and also even of just singers on the street. They often think singers are in league with pickpockets. The Lord Mayor in the 1810s comes out and writes this. He says, if they're singing, that's to get your attention, just so someone can come up behind you and nick your stuff, which is blatant nonsense, except in one case I found where there was a girl of about 15 and her young brother, where they were actually operating this racket. They're very rare cases. I don't want to say this is common, but it's amazing when you find them.
Singing in the streets. So we're talking, I mean, you can't move from somebody being a statue somewhere or somebody knocking out a bleeding Ed Sheeran song and yeah. That. So, but singing in the streets was again part of, presumably that was a way of making, you know, getting by and making a little bit of money if you had a lovely voice.
Yeah, or even if you didn't, and people are awfully damning about these voices. Well, and it doesn't matter, because, again, this period, say the 1830s, is when the idea of busking is invented in London, if you like. And John James Beazer, who's one of my favourite characters in the book, he's first on the streets at the age of 7. He's selling hot cross buns. He's literally going, hot cross buns, hot cross buns. But he's so ashamed of doing this on the street, he whispers it, and he doesn't sell any buns. Then later, when he's about 21, he's out of work, he's got a wife who's ill in childbirth, he's cast on the streets again. And then he decides he's going to sing literally for their supper. And he sings the hymn tunes he sings in church. He gets awfully embarrassed about this as well. But he, by then, has a strong, lusty voice. And very cleverly, he spends the first pennies he's given on gin, which gives him the confidence and the warmth and the courage to sing more loudly. But that idea of busking, that you might give people money just for the pleasure of their song, is very new. Far more common is what we call ballad singing, because this is how people, you get your songs, you get your music, because this is pre-recording. If you want song in the home, in the pub, you've got to make it yourself. And for that, you need a song that you can sing. And so what you do is, a ballad singer is someone who has bought copies of a song from a printer. And those are sheets of paper, say roughly A4 in size, maybe cut down the middle, just verses. It's just the words and a picture, not the music. And so the ballad singer has to be able to read, as just the buyer, and they have to have learnt the melody. Either they choose it themselves, or they listen outside a theatre, or they're taught it by the publisher on a violin. And then they are singing on street corners, at markets, at fairs, anywhere they can be heard and seen. And they're singing to attract people to them, but to teach the tune and to recommend the song. So you're not buying the performance, you're buying the song and the knowledge of being able to sing it yourself. So you buy it, you listen to them two or three times, you get the tune by ear. And you buy the words and you go away, and then you can pass the song on. And that's how music of all kinds travels in, well, Western Europe, North America, for centuries.
Fascinating. What of these now disappeared street nomadic sort of traditions would you like to see brought back? What would you really like to see brought back to London? I mean, apart from obviously oysters on the streets for next to nothing.
I'd like to be able to get ministers cheaply. That's very true. I think the theatre, the drama of it, is lacking. There are so many people who are just incredibly good entertainers, but there's a sense of ritual, and you get these sort of common events where, just in the midst of quite grim life, just beauty and joy breaks out. And this happens on particular days, and whenever there's a holiday, a holy day or something, you just get these mass manifestations on the street. I'd like Bartholomew Fair to come back.
Oh, yeah.
Just these huge occasions when everyone... You just have these wonderful mass events that are fabulous. As apart from that, the traditions, I don't know. It's not that compatible with a welfare state and decent standards of living for people, because so much of this ingenuity and brilliance comes out of desperation.
And
it's beautiful, but at the same time,
it's fascinating, because I remember that you just said hot cross buns, one a penny, two a penny, hot cross buns, and I remember my mother saying that to me. So that must have been that must have been in the conscience, because my mother's from Glasgow, so that must have been in the public conscience for literally for centuries. That rhyme,
yeah, for centuries, it absolutely has. And by the way, there's still no clear consensus among scholars on why it's one a penny, two a penny. Because if you think about it, it doesn't make much sense. It's sort of the original buy one, get one free. But at what point do you get them for two a penny? Is it when they're cold cross buns? And that's what John James Beazer says. By the time he's finished singing his song, he says they're cold as the corpse of a Laplander. And presumably he'd give you about 10 for a penny then. I know, and a bit of an off-colour thing in the 1820s, but it's his way of getting across the... Just how sad that is.
How do you take this and put it into a narrative? Because there's so much going on. And that you could have, this could have been a tome, couldn't it? I mean, it could have been the size of the Tibetan Book of the Dead on steroids. So what was...
Well, I wanted to avoid a tome, and I wanted to avoid it being like Henry Mayhew's London Labour and the London Poor, which is four enormous volumes, interviews, and they're categorised by the work that people do. And so many of these previous works, they're organised by sort of taking the individuality and the humanity out and looking at people as figures. The Cries of London, that's another thing, like, this is the dustman, this is the oyster girl, and this is their song, this is their cry. And it just makes them picturesque, and it denies them their individuality. So to have an organising principle, I wanted to restore something of biography. And then the other thing is, when people are on the street, you don't actually ever have that much about one person's life. So we've got all these fascinating incidents, these really moving vignettes of particular moments in people's lives, often when they're in trouble with the law. And so I've organized it into a life story. So there's a chapter on infancy, one on young boys, one on young women, one on immigrants to London, one on professionals. It's sort of the high point of making it in the street. Then on people in trouble, the renegades, and then finally on old age. And so I've got a sort of, a cradle to grave story of life on the streets. And some individuals come back from chapter to chapter. We meet them early on when they're sort of like, Beezer's a great example, because we meet him when he's 7 and he's desperate. Then we meet him when he's 21. He's still desperate, but he's a lot better at dealing with it. Billy Waters, we see him. This is a black fiddler with one leg that he's lost in service in the Royal Navy. We meet him at his height when he's the sort of most celebrated busker on the London streets. And then we meet him on his deathbed, and it's really tragic. The way that fate has dealt with him, he dies in a workhouse. So there's this story. People come back, but you really feel you've been on a journey with them. And that way, I get all of the most exciting bits of people's lives in constantly.
It sounds absolutely wonderful. I can't wait to get my hands on this one. The book is called Vagabonds: Life on the Streets of 19th Century London. It is by Oscar Jensen, who we're speaking to today. Oscar, if people want to find you online, where can they track you down?
Yeah. I mean, Google was a good start. And just remember, Oscar is with a K and Jensen is Jensen. But Twitter at Oscar Cox Jensen. My website is oscarjensen.co.uk or oscarcoxjensen.com. They'll find you. It's an unusual name. You'll get there quite easily. And the book is in all the places you would expect.
And it will be available as a virtual download from our own virtual bookstore. The book is
Buy the ebook,
absolutely. You should sing it as an audio book. That would be the one. You know, I can see it.
There will be an audio book coming, and I might have to crack out a bit of singing for that.
Listen. I mean, that brief operatic bit was absolutely brilliant. The book is called Vagabonds: Life on the Streets of 19th Century London. It's by Oscar Jensen, Oscar Cox Jensen. Oscar, really, it's been absolutely brilliant this morning. Thank you so much for your time today.
It's been joy. Thank you, Giles. Thanks, everyone.